The Center for Healing Trauma and Attachment, or CATA, founded by the visionary Doreen Hills, is dedicated to providing innovative and compassionate treatment for those seeking profound healing. CATA's mission is clear: to offer driven, passionate, and cutting-edge therapeutic approaches that not only heal trauma, but also address the needs of the soul. They believe that true healing goes beyond symptom management and is about restoring wholeness. So whether you're an individual seeking therapy, a provider, a therapist looking for training, or a member of the community in need of support, CATA offers quality and affordable trainings tailored to your unique needs. To learn more, visit chtainc.org. That's chtainc.org. All right, welcome back to the Trauma Therapist Podcast. My name is Guy McPherson. My mission is to raise awareness of trauma and to support and inspire new trauma therapists just starting out on the trauma-informed journey. I do that with my membership community, Trauma Therapist 2.0, my online courses and workshops, and the Trauma Therapist newsletter. If you're a therapist of any kind and you work with individuals who've been impacted by trauma, I invite you to head on over to my website at thetraumatherapistproject.com. That's thetraumatherapistproject.com. All right, let's get started. Five, four, three, two, and one. All right, folks, welcome back to the Trauma Therapist Podcast. I am very excited to have back Kate Filan. Kate, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
So Kate is an accredited mental health social worker and a play therapist. She was originally on the podcast about 3 years ago on episode 335. She began her social work career in frontline child protection, assessing risk to children, working with kids and families to reduce risk, and where necessary, placement of children in out-of-home care. Kate's trained and experienced in forensic risk assessments and investigative interviewing. She's presented evidence in children's court, family law court, and criminal court, and she's managed a team of child protection workers before going into private practice. All right, Kate, there's a lot more that we need to talk about in terms of your background, but that'll give people a gist of what you're doing. Before we get going here, share with our listeners where you're from originally and where you are currently.
Thanks, Guy. Yes, today I'm on Gayamagal land, which is the beautiful northern beaches of Sydney, Australia. It is Aboriginal land, and daily I acknowledge the impact of colonisation for Aboriginal people across Australia. I'm originally an Irish person from the northeast coast of Ireland, a tiny little rural town along the seaside. Came to Australia when I was in my late 20s and have been here since.
Awesome, awesome. So what, okay, bring us up to speed. What has been going on in your life with your work since we talked last?
I was in private practice doing therapy and assessment for children and families in the Family Law Court of Australia. So working with both victim survivors who are children and adults, and also working with fathers who perpetrated violence on their intimate partners and children. Since then, I have moved into an organisation where I manage a program that engages men who perpetrate violence and their partners and former partners. So I'm the Family Safety Manager for Relationships Australia, which is a non-government organisation across Australia, but I manage the state of New South Wales, their family safety programs.
Okay.
So, yeah.
All right. So what does that mean? What does that look like? What do you do?
So what do I do? So I have six teams of primarily social workers who men are referred either voluntarily, so they decide themselves that they need to look at what's happening in their behaviour and how they have been unsafe in their relationships, or primarily a lot are referred through court. So that's through children's court, which is child protection, or family law court, because the relationship has ended and one of the parties has gone to family law court to resolve child-related issues usually. So men are referred to our program, and as part of that, they have to Share details of their partner or former partner that they have children with. And we engage and support the safety of the partner and former partner as well. And we work with men in a men's behavioural change framework to accept responsibility and to be held accountable for their behaviour and then to begin to change their behaviour so they engage safely with either their current partner, former partner, and or children.
Okay. So I remember we talked about this last time, and I remember I asked you, and we kind of talked about just the fact that you're working with these, and these are all men, with yeah. these men, and how, I mean, for my, it's an intense thing to be working with perpetrators. How did you get into this, that specialization? What drew you there?
I started my own, like say, clinical work with men in 2009, where doing child protection work when I was managing that child protection team, we were noticing that, so we'd work with one family and help the mom and children become safe. And usually what happened, the dad was not engaged. The relationship would end, the children would either be removed if the risk was too high to stay with mom, or they will be supported with mom and move into a refuge and then get more stable accommodation. And we were noticing that once we did that with one family, a man was re-emerging with a second family, and more women and more children were being impacted by the same man's lack of safety. So at that point, I approached the Statutory Child Protection Agency and said, look, are you noticing the same trend? Because we are. And they said yes. And then I sought out training from two experts in the field and trained my team in engaging
so
men.
So let me interrupt you for a second. So just to be clear here, so you'd be working with one man and his family, either partner or kids, you'd kind of work with them and to create safety for them, but then he would engage with another woman or family and perpetrate there as well.
Yeah, at that stage, child protection wasn't engaging with the man, so he was either removed from the house, or the children and mom were removed to a refuge, or the children were being removed because it was viewed as the mother's responsibility to keep her children safe. Okay. So a real kind of patriarchal view of parenting. And at that point, the services weren't engaging with men, usually because it was they were risky, they were using violence, they were harder to engage, they were quite invisible from the family. So they would kind of be not part of the process. The relationship would end, and then they would reappear in another relationship with another baby, another child, and then the cycle would repeat itself in his behavior becoming or being violent, controlling. And then the family would be presenting then at police, hospital, and child protection would become involved again. So it was that view or experience that I was witnessing and being part of, that this is never going to change unless we engage the men. We're going to continuously kind of be pulling families out at the bottom of the river or the bottom of the waterfall, that we kind of have to go back up and look at, well, what can we do to change the current narrative? And I suppose in relation to domestic violence, having worked in this field for over 20 years, we didn't respond to domestic violence 20 years ago. It was viewed as a family problem. To say 10 years ago, or a bit more, where we were viewing it as a woman's problem. So it was the mother's responsibility to keep her children safe, and not engage the man. To now, we're seeing that, you know, he has to be visible, he has to be part of it, and also being, you know, so showing some compassionate to most men want a relationship with their children that's safe, and being using that as a motivator to be able to ignite change or ignite responsibility for their behavior, that if you are safe, then your relationship with your child can be safe and can be meaningful. Whereas when you're not safe, your child's afraid of you, your partner's afraid of you, you know, they're all at risk from you. So that's where I changed and started working with perpetrators, because it's never going to change if we don't engage them. And bring them into the system that works with their family, you know, hold them accountable, and they become planners, they become responsible and change their behavior.
So with the understanding that all people are different, are there certain generalities or traits that these men who are perpetrating this violence and or abuse showing? I mean, there's the adage, right? Hurt people hurt people. Is that true here?
I see two types of, well, not two is a bit broad, but there's, you know, families, men that come from a trauma background and have had experiences themselves of DV, and they're quite reactive. But what really feeds perpetration of domestic violence is belief systems. One of those is entitlement and patriarchy and gender roles and how men are socialized. But most men that come and perpetrate domestic violence have that sense of entitlement that I can behave how I want to behave. Mm-hmm. I can be treated how I want to be treated, and I can ensure that the people around me behave in a way that I want them to, or that meet my needs by behaving in a certain way. So, you know, control, threats.
So in sense of entitlement, so you're saying that the majority or are the majority, have the majority been abused themselves or been, so interesting. Okay. Yes. Have the majority experienced trauma?
It depends on certain socioeconomic locations. Definitely mm-hmm. the majority coming through would come from, you know, families where there has been domestic violence themselves growing up. Whereas in other locations, say more affluent areas, there isn't a sense of, there's definitely kind of patriarchy and, you know, the man is the head of the house and this is the way a man is okay to behave. But not all of that. I think it would be unfair to say for men who have grown up in trauma, they don't, not all of them go on and perpetrate domestic mm-hmm. violence, and being mindful and respectful to, you know, victim survivors, male victim survivors themselves, that that don't do it, that it isn't all men that experience trauma.
But you're saying the majority do have the sense of entitlement. And that's interesting, because I mean, entitlement is one thing, but manifesting it or expressing it in this way, I guess the question is why? Right? I mean, entitlement can mean, well, I want that car, I'm gonna go take that car, or so help us understand the process here, the what's going on.
So in terms of the men that we would work with, so patriarchy as well is a view, so how women are viewed in the world and how they're viewed in the world of the man that perpetrates domestic violence as well, and gender roles that come into play. Male socialization as well is, I think, how we parent our boys is a huge impact in how gender roles play out, how they process beliefs and attitudes. And then where entitlement comes in. I think religion has a place as well. Can add to it. Having come from a very Catholic background myself, I can speak on that. And looking at where men are placed in the priest is the hierarchy of the community. What he says goes is kind of just an example of how male role models play out, and men are perceived as, I suppose, being more important than women, so therefore their needs are met, and women are in a place to meet those needs, and particularly in a relationship as well.
Now, often, and correct me if I'm wrong, when the topic of domestic violence against women occurs, there's this idea that, you know, it isn't really about sex. It's about power or control. Does this come into play here as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Power and control is one of the key components of domestic violence, and non-incident domestic violence is becoming more accepted. That lots of men engage in domestic violent behavior aren't actually physically violent, so it's around power and control. And a lot of, like, New South Wales at the moment, the state that I'm in, is looking at legalizing coercive control. I know Scotland and Ireland have done it.
Legalizing?
Coercive control.
What do you mean legalizing coercive control? That sounds awful.
Well, there is a lot of debate about how helpful it will be. So coercive control looks at a pattern of behavior, a pattern of control. So say how, and it's used to ultimately manage and control your, you know, your target, your partner's behavior, in order to, to make sure that everything they do is controlled by you. So tech abuse, stalking, your time is controlled, when you're allowed out of the house, when, who you're allowed to see, what you can do at home. I worked with a victim survivor who, if there was bubbles left on the kitchen floor when she cleaned it, that would result in a verbal onslaught of, you know, name calling.
But you're saying certain areas are legalizing this?
Yeah, Scotland and Ireland have legalized it.
How?
About, exactly. And that's what Marsha Scott is a big in Scotland on the topic, and I think they have successfully gone through, charged, convicted less than five men, because it is so hard to, it's up to the victim ultimately to, well, as in it is any crime really, to prove. And it's been placed in the, it will be placed in the, up to the police to make this decision. And at the end of the day, the police, you know, they're not trained in coercive control. Mm-hmm. They're trained in, you know, a physical evidence kind of gathering basis. There's also, you know, a lot of, like, the place is quite a patriarchal setup as well. So concerns around how this will be placed and how this will be used as a piece of legislation, both by perpetrators as well towards their victims, as another form of control and abuse. So yeah, it's I think in terms of acknowledging coercive control, it's a good understanding to move away from incidences and look at patterns of behavior. So looking at, you know, that it isn't the traditional black eye, mm-hmm. that it's looking at, you know, financial control, emotional abuse, right. Sexual abuse.
I didn't hit her.
Yeah.
Well, nothing happened. I didn't hit her. Right.
Yeah. But that, you know, your partner and children aren't allowed outside the house after 4 p.m. or they're not allowed to go to after school activities because she might meet a dad, and you might think that, you know, who's she talking to? You know, that kind of impact for women and children.
Oh, man. What is your experience with the success rate with the work? This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, like I am, you're going to have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, and set up recurring or one-time chores, all customized to your family's needs. When I was a kid, I had to do chores. Had money been transferred afterwards as a result, I think I would have had so much more motivation. All the while, your kids are learning to build financial literacy and independence. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/traumatherapist. That's greenlight.com/traumatherapist to try Greenlight for free. Once again, go to greenlight.com/traumatherapist. You're doing.
Define success.
Right, quote unquote success. How do you find success? How do you define success? Let me step back. How do you work with these individuals, these units, the perpetrators and the family?
Yeah, how do we work with them? So, and I have to say that primarily my workforce is female. So it is, there's, you know, first step is being safe for my practitioners. So, you know, looking at how safe workers are in engaging men. So there's criteria that men need to engage, you know, to demonstrate before they will be kind of accepted into our program. And the first point of that is, in a clinical intake, being able to kind of name an aspect of their behavior that is not safe and that they, you know, kind of want to engage in. Because a lot will ring up and say, I have to do this for court. It's a court order. Mm-hmm. I didn't do anything. And she's made all that up. And now the court's believing her because, you know, the courts favor mothers, blah, blah, blah. So at that point, we'd spend some time with them doing a clinical intake to see whether there's any shift. And if there isn't, well, then it would be saying to him, you're not sitting in a place where you're able to start this work. And this is a choice that you have made, because domestic violence is a choice. And engaging in that behavior and control is a choice. These men don't lose it at their colleagues in work, or, you know, they make a choice to do it in their home towards their partners and children. And at that point, if he's able to say, yes, look, I wasn't safe. And you might get one incident where, you know, he's able to name that, yes, this happened. And then they'll be accepted into our program for assessment. And as part of that assessment, we get contact details for partners, because often their sense of safety is a really good evaluation of, you know, what he's telling us and what's really happening at the in the home. A lot of men will come with ADVOs, which is apprehended domestic violence orders. So they're orders that are in place to protect usually the mom and children, and they can have a range of, you know, no contact at all to, you know, allow telephone contact, mm-hmm. or the most minimum one is, you know, you can still be in the same home, but you're not allowed to harass, intimidate, threaten. There's a list of behaviors on it. So once they come into assessment, we start working with them around, you know, what are their motivators? So what is it they think they need to work on? Mm-hmm. Then in terms of starting to evaluate, you know, what are their values? What are their beliefs? What are their attitudes that have led to this behavior or sit under this behavior that gives them what they view as the right to, you know, engage in control and abuse towards their partners and children. A huge shift is recognizing, and this in the programs that I manage has been a change in the last while since I've taken over, is recognizing children as victim survivors in their own right. Mm-hmm. A lot of the research has looked at children being, you know, witnesses or present when it's happening. Whereas when we sit with children, they have been victims. They often of coercive control. So, you know, working with a child who's told me that when she's on contact with her mom and if she meets her mom in the supermarket, she's not allowed to speak to her mom because it's time with dad. And if she does, that will result in punishment for her. So that's an example of a child being coercively controlled. Nice. Children often miss out on after school activities because they're not allowed to do them. They're not allowed to go to birthday parties. They're not allowed because of his behavior, because he's concerned who his partner might be in contact with while she's there.
Right. Let me interrupt you here for a minute, Kate. So do these, and again, I know it's difficult to make generalities, but To what degree do a lot of these men, these individuals, understand that what they're doing is harmful, is abusive? And I say that within the context of you saying initially that a lot of this derives from their belief systems.
Yeah, it does. Some will get to a point where they're able to say that they can see that their partner was scared of them. Mm-hmm. The men that I have worked with have been fathers, so seeing the impact of what their behavior has had on their children can often come quicker than what it's had on their partner. And that's based on belief systems, based on, you know, a different sense of empathy for a child. And it's really working in that space of being able to separate from what she's done. Victim stance is one of the patterns that they sit in, that, you know, it wasn't me, it was the cord, or she pushed my buttons, and mm-hmm. kind of demonstrating that, you know, that they're kind of that sit in a lack of blame or minimization of what their behavior is. And it is really through, you know, setting up a space with them that is, I do like Bruce Perry's 3 R's, where you relate and regulate, and then you get to the reason part of a person's brain. But being clear that when we're relating and regulating to them, it's in a place of, you know, boundaries. It's in a place of setting up that this is how we behave safely. This is how we engage in respectful communication and relationships, in how we work together. This is how I'm going to challenge you in terms of when you tell me something that isn't safe. We're going to sit in a space of, we're going to look at your behavior. We're going to, you know, pivot it back to your behavior in that incidence where you're giving me an example of what she did. Okay, talk me through what you did. And that can be difficult for men to do initially, but getting to them to that point where, so the use of the kind of the fly on the wall, I do it where, you know, the fly is looking this way, what would the fly see this way, in order for them to kind of sit with telling me what you did, as opposed to telling me what she's done to you in your perception of what's happened.
So, you know, as you're talking, I'm listening, but I'm also thinking that their mental state, their state of being, could be different in the moment during which they are doing this, compared to when they're in your office and reflecting back. And I'm just curious about that. To be able to perpetrate these acts, and I guess especially against kids, I mean, one, you can make a strong argument for one almost being a sociopath, right? Having no sense of empathy. Walk us through, what is your response to that?
A lot of, he's a narcissist, and because narcissism is in the DSM, it always has that kind of reaction because, look, there's probably aspects that would, but it's really separating at that. If this was a sociopath or if this was a narcissist, you'd see this behavior across all relationships and all interactions that this person would have. Right. Whereas with domestic violence, it's a choice. It doesn't happen, you know, when he's, you know, on the committee for the local soccer team. He's, you know, it doesn't happen when he's, you know, gone to church. It doesn't happen when, you know, he's in work and he's, you know, presenting to his colleagues on whatever he presents on. It does, and his colleague disagrees with him, or his colleague, you know, that's where it doesn't happen, that it is a choice. It's around, I have the power and control in my relationships based on the belief systems and attitudes of entitlement, gender role, patriarchy. But look, it is important to recognize that, you know, mental health as well. If a man has a diagnosis of mental health, it's around around supporting where that is as well, that, you know, and we look at making sure that there is a separate service that would support that aspect of his needs too. So it isn't, I suppose we're kind of like a fine line where people ask, are we men's rights? We're definitely not men's rights. What underpins our work is victim survivor safety and well-being. Mm-hmm. But we do...
My implication wasn't to suggest that they necessarily had a particular diagnosis. Mm. And what I was curious about, and I'm curious about, you know, in that moment, right? I mean, when looking at it from my perspective, from an outsider's perspective, in that moment, I'm curious, like, what the hell is going on? I mean, this, you could say this about any type of perpetrated violence. Is there anything, you know, yes, it's a choice, but Jesus, what kind of choice is that? I mean, you know, how does someone do this to my God, it's just so horrific.
Yes, it is. It really is. And I think, yeah, it is what, and I suppose how do they do it? It's often such a entrenched belief system that they don't, looking at it involves such shame that it's often minimized.
They don't look at it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
So when they start work with us, it's really like Ellen Jenkins is kind of the forefounder of men's behavioral change, and where we place shame and reposition the shame so that you look at the man's values and the man that he wants to be, and bring him on that journey. It's kind of a narrative approach to bring him on that journey through reflection, through opening, you know, conversations around and the use of self as well. I'm going to give you some, you know, observations or some, can I give you some reflections that I have. I've just experienced that moment as quite intimidating. Your behavior was, you know, and then you can name it. You know, what was that like for you hearing that from me? Has anyone given you that feedback before? Mm-hmm. What's happening in your system for you now as you hear that? Okay, so if we were to have this conversation again, how do you think you could, you know, be hearing that I experienced that as intimidation? So it's kind of use of self in that moment, mm-hmm. that you have a space with a man where, you know, he is able to kind of sit in some of that shame, because if we can reposition that shame, then you know, that's what aspects of success look like when you, mm-hmm. when we started down there, what does success look like? And, you know, being really realistic that sometimes visibility is success. So sometimes having a man in a service while we work with the police, with the victim survivor and the children to build safety, right. And allow her have the support to ignite her safety plan that she was planning to leave, but just didn't have a service around him, because often when he's visible in our service, there's, you know, information and knowledge that, because no other service works with both partners at the same time, so nobody holds both narratives of, okay, he's telling us this, mm-hmm. but this is really what's happening from, you know, the family's perspective, or he's not telling us this, so this is creating more risk. So then we can work really closely with the support services to kind of look at, well, this is what our risk assessment is, and, you know, either we need to kind of respond more from, you know, breaching his AVO, or we need to look at what sort of support service can we put in for the family in order to help them, you know, ignite a safety plan. Women are really good at keeping themselves and their children safe, but it's not their responsibility. It's right. it's his behavior.
Let me ask you this, as we kind of wind down here, what is, first of all, I mean, I just admire the work you're doing, and my God, I mean, it's incredible. What is this like for you to do this work? Because this is, look, let's, this is not run of the mill work. This isn't, this is very intense. I think it is. What is this like for you to do this?
Yeah, as a female doing it, now I manage teams of amazing other females that do it and support and coach and supervise and look, you know, support their practice, manage a lot of risk. As females doing this work, it can feel like it is a lot of responsibility because we're working to change men's behavior, and there's less men visible in doing the work, if that makes sense.
Right.
So women are still carrying the burden of men's lack of safety. Having said that, I think my experience as a female really allows this work, really creates a space for men to you know, to take the opportunity of that choice to be able to change. I think for men, because men come with their own male workers in, you know, in this work, come with their own gender, male privilege, their own patriarchy. And when they sit with another man, it's a kind of a, oh, you get it, mate, you know what she's like. So there's, it's kind of a space to be able to sit without colluding with them is, because we want to collaborate, we don't want to collude with men who perpetrate violence, and they're really good at getting you to collude with them. Whereas as a female, there's less of a perception from a perpetrator that you are going to kind of collude with them because you know you're a female and you're on her side, so to speak. So it's it is. I moved into management because of knowing that what I needed for my journey and wanting to still work in this field, but knowing that I was getting to a point that, hearing men just their justification or hearing another victim survivor story wasn't going to kind of support what I needed in terms of my career and being able to use the skill and experience that I had to kind of build a kind of a bigger workforce that engaged in this work. Because it's really draining work.
Yeah, man, I can imagine. Kate, what's the best way for people to reach you?
Probably LinkedIn, I'd say, is easy. Kate Fallon on LinkedIn is good.
Okay. Okay. Look, I want to thank you so much for coming back here. You are welcome back. Again, appreciate the work you're doing. To me, it takes a lot of courage what you're doing, and it's inspiring. I'm glad you are out there doing this work.
We need way more funding if you're able to do it that.
I don't know if I can, but I can help you and try to help you. I'll definitely try to do that. But again, love talking to you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, guys. Been awesome.
All right. Bye-bye.
Take care.
Thank you so much for listening and supporting this podcast. And if you'd like to join the hundreds of other therapists who are each month keeping up to date and informed and inspired about what's going on in the world of trauma, I'd love to invite you to head on over to the Trauma Therapist Newsletter. That's thetraumatherapistnewsletter.com.